Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, proudly sponsored by AJR Sports Science and Healthcare Consulting. At AJR, we are committed to offering a comprehensive range of exceptional services, including applied sports science analytics, healthcare and sports medicine consulting, and leadership and coaching development. To learn more about AJR, visit their website at ajrsportsscience.com. I'm your host, Andrew Rizza, an allied healthcare professional with over 25 years of experience. My career has primarily spanned private physical therapy and public school athletics. Driven by curiosity and a passion for the industry, I created the Behind the Sports Medicine podcast to explore the ever-evolving landscape of healthcare with a focus on sports medicine, physical therapy, athletic training, and sports science. Each week, we'll dive into the challenges healthcare professionals encounter and discuss how collaboration can enhance understanding within the industry. Our goal is to improve the experience for patients and athletes alike. Now, on to the show. On this week's Behind the Sports Medicine podcast, I'd like to welcome Dr. Zachary Fang from the Vascular Care Group in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Dr. Fang is a board-certified vascular surgeon who received his undergraduate degree from Tufts University before pursuing both his master's and medical degrees from Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Dr. Fang completed his integrated vascular surgery residency at the University of Massachusetts Medical School in Worcester prior to joining the Vascular Care Group. He holds a variety of certifications, including trauma and advanced cardiac life support. Dr. Fang has authored numerous peer-reviewed publications and has been the speaker for multiple national presentations. He is a member of professional organizations such as the Society for Clinical Vascular Surgery, the New England Society for Vascular Surgery, and the Society for Vascular Surgery. Now, on to the show. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the session of Behind the Sports Medicine podcast. Today, I have Dr. Zachary Fang from the Vascular Care Group. Dr. Fang came and spoke to our team over at ATI Physical Therapy in Wellesley about 8 or 9 weeks ago. And quite frankly, I really didn't know about one of the procedures they provide, which is pretty amazing. It's called GAE. So I'm going to have Dr. Fang today talk about that and how his group provides this service for the knee population and get into more of where this could be hopefully applied in the future. So Dr. Fang, welcome to the podcast today.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and kind of your journey to where you are today working in vascular care?
Yeah, so I'm a board-certified vascular surgeon. I work for the Vascular Care Group out of the Wellesley office. I went to med school at Emory and did my integrated vascular surgery residency at UMass, which is how I ended up back up in New England. I've got family in this area. And I love vascular surgery because, you know, you get kind of long-term relationships with your patients because a lot of the diseases never really go away. Unfortunately, we just treat them, but they never are 100% cured. But we have both minimally invasive procedures and maximally invasive procedures. And that's also really appealing to me as a physician. So I do most of my outpatient procedures and out of the Wellesley office. But, you know, if I need to do open surgery, I do that either at Newton Wellesley Hospital or at Metro West. And I also see patients in Framingham as well.
That's great. Can you tell us a little bit about the practice and how many of the vascular surgeons actually provide GAE, which is, I think, the one reason that kind of raised an eyebrow for me was, like, this seems like an awesome procedure that can provide some great relief for the patients that we see that are either, you know, going on the road of a total knee or had a total knee, and, you know, where are they at this point with their pain management? So can you speak a little bit more to that?
Yeah, absolutely. So our group has about 20 vascular surgeons currently, and we've got offices mostly in Massachusetts, although we also have one in Portland, Maine, and one in Darien, Connecticut. But almost all of the offices are starting to offer GAE. Our office was the first when we started in February. So everyone's started to kind of slowly move in that direction, and everyone's picking it up because there's really not a lot of practitioners who are offering this otherwise, kind of in the whole New England area, as far as we know. There are a couple out in Western Mass, but there's a real need for this service here. Our office, you know, we're vascular surgeons. We treat kind of the full spectrum of vascular disease, from aneurysms to PAD, Crohn's disease, you know, varicose veins. We do it all. But GAE is a new minimally invasive procedure, or newer minimally invasive procedure that we just started offering. So we're very excited about it.
Yeah, that's good. Can you explain a little bit more about what it is and how it can help patients, especially, you know, for clinicians that don't know what this is and has that patient that's like just struggling with knee pain?
So it's for knee osteoarthritis. So I think before we talk about GAE, we probably just need to mention that, you know, this is specifically for knee osteoarthritis, either primary osteoarthritis from, you know, in your older patients who just kind of have that wear and tear picture. But also it does seem to work for post-traumatic osteoarthritis as well. But it's specifically for knee pain in that population. And the idea behind that is that knee osteoarthritis is really like it's a whole joint disease. You know, you have wear and tear of the cartilage, which is what was really thought to be the primary driver for a long time. But I think it's evolved over time that people realize that it's also the muscles surrounding the knee. It's the joint capsule as well. It's the bones attached. It's not just the cartilage itself. So one of the things that happens when you lose all that cartilage and you have that bone-on-bone grinding in knee osteoarthritis is it generates a lot of inflammation. And one of the chronic processes that happens there as well is neovascularization, where you just get proliferative growth of really small blood vessels on the capillary level. So when the body sends out a signal that says, hey, we need inflammation here, there's something wrong, it responds by sending inflammatory mediators, basically, you know, cell signaling, cytokines, things like that, to that area. And those, by and large, travel through the bloodstream. And so the way GAE works is that we target the small blood vessels, the genicular arteries that feed the joint capsule, and using microbeads or microspheres that are about 200 microns in diameter, we block off some, but not all of those little capillaries, and we block the inflammatory mediators from actually getting to their site of action. So we block the inflammation signal, so you have less inflammation and thus less pain. What this means for patients is that, you know, it does really well with dealing with the sharp pain, really well with, you know, some patients will come back and say, hey, my stiffness has gone down because they have a little bit less swelling as well, although there's not a ton of data on the swelling aspect itself. But I think, we always stress to patients that the bone-on-bone, the mechanical issue of bone-on-bone, this doesn't fix that. You know, that can only be fixed by a total knee replacement.
Mm-hmm.
One of the great things about this, though, is that if patients have residual pain after they get a total knee, you know, they still have chronic inflammation in the knee joint area, or the tissue surrounding the prosthetic, you can still do this procedure. Those arteries are still there. The capillaries are still there. We can still embolize them, and there's still good results in terms of pain relief.
And that was my next question for you, you know, because you went off and started talking about how you can do a post-surgical, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is it something that is appropriate for someone that has a TKA or even an ACL reconstruction or, you know, other big chondral injuries? What's the criteria for you to be able to say, well, we can actually do this?
I would say for someone who's had like a reconstruction of some sort, so far the only real indication is for, to my knowledge, is for a total knee replacement.
Mm-hmm.
If someone's had like a meniscal surgery or an ACL repair, but they don't really have that diagnosis of osteoarthritis, there's not as much of an indication there. Just there's not as much data out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that being said, we've had patients who have come in and they've said, hey, yeah, I've had my meniscus repaired or trimmed kind of years ago, and now I've developed knee osteoarthritis, which often happens, you know, further on down the line. Those patients are all candidates.
Yeah.
But it's not a procedure for postoperative pain unless it's from a total knee and they still have that chronic inflammation aspect.
Okay. I mean, that's great, I think, for the clinicians that are listening out there to be able to understand how this can benefit their patient, because there are certainties where we have patients and we're trying to bring them through that have osteoarthritis to get them healthier, feel better, get them stronger, and you're still not getting rid of that pain component. Now, when you mention pain, what's the criteria for pain? I mean, we have a pain scale, but when do you say to the patient, hey, I think I want to refer them over to see Dr. Fang and his group to have a consult? When would you as a clinician or as a surgeon say, well, your pain level is high enough that this warrants this procedure? Is it case by case and daily function, the ability to function, or is it truly a pain related discussion?
I think it's more of a function related discussion. You know, if a patient comes in, they say, I have pain in my knee. I walk around, I have pain in my knee, but you know what? It doesn't bother me. Like, I can stand it. It's not a big deal. I don't mind that much. Then that patient doesn't really need a procedure, right? Because they can live it. But if someone's saying, hey, like, you know, I've got this pain in my knee, it's really bugging me. It interferes my ability to go out on walks. I can't climb up and down stairs. I got to stop and rest. I'm always favoring my knee. It's causing issues on the other side because I'm favoring the right side. So my left knee is starting to hurt now. Anything that where, you know, it's starting to impact their lifestyle, then we can have a discussion about, hey, how bad is the pain? And we have them fill out, the Western Ontario and McMaster University pain scale. That's how we track it. So they fill this out before the procedure, usually at their first clinic visit. Then after the procedure, they fill it out again at the 1 month visit, the 6 month visit. And we haven't gotten there yet, but we'll plan on having them do it at the 12 month visits and the 24 month visit as well, just to make sure that the pain scale, we have an objective piece of data where that should be decreasing every time, or it should decrease down to a level and then plateau out.
Okay.
Because it is supposed to be durable like that. It's supposed to last several years.
Okay. Yeah. And are there, when you get a patient referred over to you, is there a list of comorbidities that you say, you know, we shouldn't be doing this for you? Is there that patient, or is it to the point where you can provide that given, you know, whatever their daily, you know, their function is?
That's a really great question. And the truth of the matter is no one is really too sick. A lot of the things, you know, we think that this is really something that it doesn't replace knee replacement, right? It's another tool in the toolbox in terms of augmentation for getting patients ready for surgery, or if patients don't ever want to have knee surgery, it's something they can have as a destination therapy. But the only people who I really think should not have this done are people who just have a knee surgery that's scheduled, that's coming up.
Okay.
I think we're very strong believers in total knee replacement being the definitive therapy for knee osteoarthritis, but not everyone is a candidate for total knee replacement.
Mm-hmm. You know,
patients who generally are too sick for a knee replacement, who have been turned down, are some of like the prime candidates for genicular artery embolization.
Yeah.
We generally think of these patients kind of in like three categories, right? So there's the patients who want to delay a knee replacement for as long as possible, either because they are young and the prosthetics don't last forever, or if they just, you know, they've had a bad experience, or they know someone in their family or a friend who had a bad experience with knee replacement, they just don't want surgery. That's one category. Patients who aren't candidates due to their comorbidities, like they've been turned down, their surgeon says, hey, lose 15 pounds and then I'll do your knee replacement, or exercise and get off all of your pain meds and then I'll do your knee replacement, or hey, like your heart and your lungs are just too sick, I can't do this.
Yeah.
Those patients are very appropriate for this because it's minimally invasive.
Okay.
Go ahead, and then the patients who have already had a knee replacement but continue to have pain, like we talked about.
Okay. Now, for someone that has that knee replacement, how does the procedure change? Because we think of a knee replacement, they're replacing the, you know, the chondral surfaces and putting in, you know, hardware. So how do you navigate that? Are you going through the side of the joint surface? Are you going through the open spaces are there? How does that work?
So this is all done through blood vessels. So, you know, part of my job as a vascular surgeon is endovascular techniques. So accessing a blood vessel either in the upper thigh or in the foot, and then navigating through the arteries to the knee joint. The genicular arteries aren't actually, in a standard knee replacement, they're still there afterwards. They're not disrupted. They're not ligated. They all still exist. And all of those, or a lot of the small little capillaries and the hypervascularization that comes from the chronic inflammation is still present as well. So the most challenging thing there is that because we do this with fluoroscopy, where patients come in, it's an outpatient procedure, they're awake, but they're usually sedated. So they're kind of in twilight. So they're relaxed and most people end up taking a nap. But I have to basically move the live X-ray detector in different angles to get a better visualization of the arteries, because the big prosthetic is like a big prosthetic shaped block that I can't see through.
Yeah.
So instead of going for a normal GA for someone who hasn't had a knee replacement, we might go for three or four of the six arteries around the joint capsule. We'll go for maybe one to two or two to three.
Okay.
Because we just can't see all of them and get there safely.
Okay. Now, I'm sure people are thinking when, you know, they're listening to this, well, you're blocking off vessels. Is there any, risk to that? And how can you speak to, you know, how that works? And do these vessels regrow kind of like a root system? How does that work?
So that's a really great question. It's the genicular artery embolization is a bit of a misnomer because we're not actually embolizing is just blocking off, right? We're not actually blocking off the genicular arteries. We're blocking off the little capillaries that come off of the genicular arteries.
Okay.
And these are, we're talking about blood vessels that are so small that we don't have devices that are small enough to get into those ones. So that's why we use the microbeads, because they are small enough that they can travel through the genicular arteries, but then they get lodged at the very end vessels, which are the capillaries.
Mm-hmm.
There's theoretically a risk of blocking off the genicular artery itself. There are a lot of collateral pathways. So you wouldn't, the risk of actually having any sort of damage to the knee itself is extremely low.
Okay.
And in all of the data and the studies that have been done, that hasn't happened. But something that theoretically, because you're doing an embolization procedure, everyone is always concerned about. Just the standard risks of having any sort of minimally invasive procedure. I'm putting a needle through the skin into a blood vessel. So there's a small risk of bleeding. There's a small risk of infection. And I always tell patients when I do a procedure that I work with blood vessels, so there's a small risk of blood clots. That's just part and parcel of working with blood vessels. Sometimes you touch them and they say, hey, blood clot. Luckily, we have a lot of blood thinners around. And if there is a blood clot, we are also the people who fix those. We're the vascular surgeons. So
they're in a good place.
we can fish it out if we needed to. Knock on wood, we have not had that happen yet or needed that. But that is that's what we tell folks. And then, you know, there's also been, it's been looked at in the literature as well. There's been no evidence of having, you know, less bleeding during a knee replacement afterwards, or of having, you know, necrosis afterwards, or poor wound healing. There's just at the capillary level, there's so many collateral pathways for blood to get there. It just ceases to be an issue unless you make some sort of like heinous error that shouldn't be there, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah. Now that's what if you have, you know, say a person that has severe arthritic changes and they just don't want to have that knee replacement. You mentioned that it's kind of one of those things that buy some time. Mm-hmm. Is there that patient that needs the replacement, says, I am not getting the replacement.
Mm-hmm.
Can this help solve, you know, that discomfort enough for them to be functional to the point where they can actually avoid the knee replacement? Or is there a discussion of, you know what, it is a, you know, stage four, we need to really think about getting this taken care of. How does that conversation go?
So the short answer is yes. Mm-hmm. Those patients definitely have the GAE definitely can be a destination therapy for those patients.
Mm-hmm.
We encourage patients to continue to follow their orthopedic surgeons and to consider knee replacement. But I definitely have several patients who come in and they say, I am absolutely not getting a knee replacement under any circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes these are folks who are younger and they just don't want it because they've had a mother or an uncle or a father who's had a really bad experience.
Mm-hmm.
But oftentimes they're also older patients who are maybe in their, you know, late 80s. And they say, you know, I don't think I can handle the recovery. Even if my orthopedic surgeon says I can, this is not something I want to risk.
Yeah.
I don't want to be immobilized for that long.
Mm-hmm.
For the recovery. And it's, I think, very appropriate to do a GA procedure on those people because we can really decrease their pain. It's just that we're very clear with them, you know, any bone on bone, the dull grinding, we can't fix. That's only can be fixed by a knee replacement.
But yeah.
The sharp pain, we can help with that.
Yeah. I might be sending my father-in-law to see you. So
happy to see him. It's not a problem.
He's, you know, I think he's 83 or four and he's, you know, both of his knees are bothering him. And I know that he is not someone that he's an old Marine. He doesn't want to have his knee done, I think. So he may be coming over to see you.
it's classic. I saw a gentleman recently who's, you know, 88 and he said, I don't want to be in a wheelchair even for a little bit, a short period of time to recover. He's just very, the patients are rightfully very concerned that, you know, as you get older and older, open surgery gets harder and harder to recover from. And it's longer and longer recovery.
Yeah, I mean, we see it in the clinic all the time. We see a ton of joint replacements between hip and knee, and we do get some shoulders. But the, you know, the discussion with the patient is like, this is a long, you know, it's a long recovery for them. I mean, therapy related, it's about 3 or 4 months maximum for them, but there's a long haul. I mean, they still have a year of feeling like they're not where they need to be. And the biggest problem is that they don't want to bend it because they're afraid to bend it. And I think a lot of that pain comes from just their, you know, from what we see is more, you know, musculoskeletal stiffness, and they just don't want to move it. And they start augmenting their gait, and that then sends them down that road of, you know, it's like a road to no return almost. And I feel bad because you're trying to get them to a functional status of being able to go up and down the stairs, to sit, to get in and out of the car and just be functional.
Right.
And that becomes a challenge. And there is some of that inherent risk. I think we talked about this when you came by, or that inherent discussion of, you know, the pain is really the relation to what they're feeling too. So where's that pain coming from? Is it neuromuscular or is it post-surgical joint related stuff?
No, it's really interesting they say that, because a lot of that stiffness, you know, I've had patients come in who they talk about the stiffness, and I don't think they quite vocalize how much that it's when they push themselves on the stiffness, they have pain.
Right.
So what the procedure can do is it helps with that pain. And so when they're pushing themselves with the stiffness and they're doing physical therapy, they don't feel that. And that is what allows them to achieve a higher functional status and really progress with their PT.
Yeah.
And I think that's where this really augments not only the post-surgical patients who, you know, might hit a plateau with their physical therapy afterwards, but also the pre-surgical patients who just need to lose a couple pounds before their surgeon will take them to the OR.
Yeah. Yeah, which is good. I mean, I think there has to be that open conversation. I think patients don't know how to ask those questions too of what they need to be able to do prior to. And some, you know, specialists will just talk about the procedure and then we'll send you to therapy after. And there's never that real big discussion on how to proceed. So I think if there's that inherent discussion, it's actually really good for the patient to understand it. I always, when I talk to patients, I say, when you speak to your surgeon or you speak to your, you know, doctor, going with the right questions, and they like, what questions are those? And we kind of go over some of the things, you know, I said, you have them captive for the time that you're with them. So just ask the questions that you feel like you need to have answered, you know, for instance, you know, when can I get back to playing tennis? You know, if they want to go back to playing tennis, is this a procedure that you recommend? Obviously you're a surgeon, you're going to recommend the procedure, but it's in the best interest of the patient. And I always say, well, what would you do if it was your wife, daughter, son, father?
Right.
That's a great question, because then the surgeon or the doctor then has to really think about, yeah, obviously if I'm providing this, this is what I would do for my family. And patients get really, I think they're afraid of surgical procedures in general, especially when they've seen, you know, other friends or family members that have had joint replacement surgeries, and either they went really well or they went really wrong, and they didn't have a good recovery, and they're very, you know, put off by it. So I always say to the therapist in the clinic, I said, never sit two knee replacements next to each other. Sit them on the other ends of the clinic, because you could have a really bad discussion going on if someone's doing great or someone's not doing great.
Well, I mean, we're always happy to see patients who are advocating for themselves. I have definitely, we definitely have a lot of folks who come in and say, you know, what would you do if I were? And oftentimes, again, it's a very easy, sometimes it's very cut and dry. It's very easy. And when you're in the hospital and you're having that inpatient conversation, then it's different.
Yeah.
But for a lot of the elective stuff we do, you know, we say, listen, this is worth it.
Yeah. And it's a great discussion. I mean, I always tell patients, like, these are, you know, doctors are human beings. They're not robots, right? I think they're like you and I. If they needed something done, they'd come see us for therapy. If we need something done, we would go see them for a procedure.
Right.
And it's just like someone that's suffering for pain other places in their body that may need a cortisone injection.
Right.
And they're afraid to get an injection. And I said, listen, if the doctor offers you an injection because you're in pain, take the injection. The worst that's going to happen is it's not going to help. The best thing is that, hey, my pain goes away. Now I can proceed with my therapy.
Right.
And again, the pain is what's holding them back most of the time. So
yeah.
It is a very good conversation to have, and to be more transparent with them about what to expect.
I always try to try to tell them, like, listen, I'm not going to do anything to you that you don't want me to do.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And they need to understand that. I think they're very reserved in some of the, and again, it's, I think some of the bad, you always hear the bad things that go on, not the good things that go on, you know, with therapy a lot of times, or what happens with the procedure. So that's always an interesting conversation to have. If you have an athlete or patient that comes to you and they're talking about resuming normal activities, you know, if it's someone that goes and is playing pickleball, or someone going to play tennis, or just someone that wants to go walk there with their grandchildren, what is your, you know, time frame for return to normal activity versus recreational sports activity?
So I just tell people, you know, in the first case, I want them to take it easy for about 48 hours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't need to lay in bed for 48 hours. They can be walking up, moving around. I just don't want them to try to like go do a lot of exercise in the first 48 hours. And that's that is not related to their knee so much as related to the access site.
Mm-hmm.
We've put a hole in an artery. Their body is healing that. It doesn't take long to heal it. And it's closed by the time they leave our office.
Mm-hmm.
But we just want to make sure that that closure is solid. All right.
Okay.
And all of our patients get a call back usually within 24 hours to just check and make sure they're doing okay. And then they see us again a week later just for an access site check mm-hmm. as well. And then in terms of regular, like strenuous activity, I would err on the side of, you know, about a week is probably fine.
Okay.
There's really, you know, from a vascular access site standpoint, the risk of anything happening at a week out is incredibly low.
Okay.
And it should be safe for them to resume, you know, full PT, you know, weightlifting, basically normal exercise, whatever they can tolerate.
Okay. And then how long before, you know, similar to someone like getting a cortisone injection for pain, mm-hmm. how quickly would they feel relief post-surgery? Is it really instantaneous? Yeah. Is it a couple of days once the anesthetic kind of
There have been people who are like, hey, it immediately feels better, but those are the rare exception.
Okay.
What we counsel patients is that the majority of folks in the first week or so will see about a 25% decrease in their pain.
Okay.
And then for about 6 weeks afterwards, every week they'll get an additional 10%-ish.
Okay.
A reduction.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time they get to, you know, 6 weeks, they're mostly kind of starting to plateau and kind of the initial how much better they're getting.
Mm-hmm.
And by 2 months, you know, by the time I see that the 1 month appointment, they're most of the way there. They'll probably still get a little bit better.
Okay.
By the time they're about 3 months out, that's probably as much as they're going to get.
Okay.
We always tell patients, you know, it's very common that in the first 48 hours afterwards, you're probably going to have a little bit of increased pain at the knee. Not everyone gets it,
mm-hmm.
But we caution everyone just an ice pack on the knee, you know, over-the-counter medications, NSAIDs, because you might have a little bit of irritation,
okay.
But that goes away on its own.
Okay.
And then other than that, you know, according to the data coming out of Japan, which is where this has been the most heavily studied, they've been tracking some patients for years and their WOMAC scores, their pain scale scores have continued to decrease back out at 2 years, 4 years, and even longer.
Okay.
But we don't have any patients who, since we just started doing this, you know, this past February, we haven't gotten to that time point yet. So I can't say that from personal experience, but that's what the data shows.
Okay. Now for patients that you've treated or even looking into the literature, when a patient has the procedure, and they're, you know, 3-4 months down the road and they start to begin to maybe have some discomfort again, when do you tell that patient, hey, give us a call back? If there's someone that's more of like a, you know, a procedure that they're going to have, you know, that patient that's the 80 plus year old patient mm-hmm. that doesn't have any replacement. When does that discussion start? Like, hey, give us a call and come back and see us and we'll talk about maybe another procedure. Mm-hmm. Is that obviously, assuming there's got to be a criteria for that.
We usually want them just because it's the same thing that they did in the initial studies. We say at least 3 months is kind of the minimum time that we have to wait before we try to do it again.
Okay.
That being said, you know, it's hopefully and ideally something that we only need to do once.
Okay.
We have had, I think, one patient where we were able to, just because of the angle of the blood vessels come off, one of my partners did a case and they were able to get some of the blood vessels, some of the jugular arteries, but they didn't get all of the ones they wanted. And they said, oh, you know, I saw another one there that probably is causing some issues, but I couldn't get into it.
Okay.
The patient came back and they said, hell yeah, I got like 50% better. You know, can we try again from a different angle and get that last blood vessel? And they did. And that patient got the rest of the way better. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so good.
It's definitely something that can be redone, but, we're trying to be very, very conservative with that because this is something that we think is, you know, probably lives in the same realm as corticosteroid injections, which, you know, are known to only last for several months, whereas this is supposed to be a much more durable treatment.
Yeah. I would think if we had some of the patients that we have that got 50% better after the first treatment, they'd be ecstatic. I mean, just pain level. I mean, we talk to them every day. I'm in pain. I can't go up and down stairs, you know, and you're trying to you know, provide care for them and they can't get over that to the next level, I think that's an amazing procedure to be able to provide that for them.
Well, getting them to the area where they're just like, hey, yeah, even if we get them to the point where it's an annoyance and inconvenience, but it's not lifestyle limiting, it's not impacting my life, I think that's a win in my book.
Yeah. I mean, I think of the people too that we deal with a lot of work conditioning patients that are work comp that come off that are going back to like municipality work, firefighters, police officers, construction workers, and they're constantly, you know, climbing ladders, going up and down, you know, construction equipment. And for those people that have that pain, and we can't progress them through their work conditioning, I'm, you know, thinking of these people as being a potential candidate that are trying to get back to their normal, you know, workflow.
Mm. If they have osteoarthritis, then, you know, there's an indication.
Yeah.
Especially if they're still working and in those fields, you know, they're generally younger men and women, and the prosthetics unfortunately don't last forever.
Yeah.
No one wants to do a redo knee replacement.
It's, right.
From my orthopod friends I talk to, it's a challenging surgery, and from the patients I talk to, it's a challenging recovery.
Yeah.
So if we can help everyone avoid that, we're here for it.
That's great. Now, if you have someone that's listening, or even a clinician that has a patient that's listening, and they're a candidate, or they think they're a candidate, what's the next step for referral over to your location or to the locations that you guys service?
Well, they can always just call our office, and ask for an appointment with, you know, one of the surgeons for a GAE eval or knee osteoarthritis eval. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our number for our offices at Wellesley is 781-304-8838.
Okay.
For practitioners, you know, we're on Epic. You can send us a referral through the normal channels. You know, we have a fax machine. Everyone seems to use still these days. Also email. Okay. I got a couple of emails from different folks saying, hey, I have a patient, or just a text message to me.
Okay.
Saying, hey, I've got this patient. Can you guys reach out to them? And we're happy to reach out to patients and set something up.
Oh, that's great. I think you guys are doing a great thing, and I'm hoping that this kind of, you know, helps a lot of us and a lot of our peers be able to get people to you that actually need this to help to get them, you know, to the next level.
There's a need, and we're happy to provide the service.
Yeah.
It's really nice being able to have people come back and just see them so happy with this.
Yeah, that's great. It's
out
great.
Of all the things we do, this is one of the ones where they come back and they're like, wow, you know, my life is so much better.
Yeah, and it's life. We talk about with everything we deal with orthopedics, this could be life-changing for the patient no matter what you're doing for them. But how do you find the next best thing for them to get them over that hump, right? Mm-hmm. And this sounds like this is the piece.
Yeah.
Looking at, you know, some of the literature and the research, and even what's coming out of Japan, you had mentioned, you know, what they're seeing in some of the data that's been 10 plus years. What about other weight bearing surfaces? Where do we see that going in the U.S. with ankles and with hips? Like, is that something coming down the road to help with patients?
I think there's more data on hips and shoulders. Okay. I don't know as much about the data on ankles.
Okay.
You know, it's definitely been done for both hips and shoulders. Our offices are not doing them currently.
Okay.
We're probably going to start doing that. When we started doing knees, we're like, okay, you know, if it goes well, we'll consider doing, you know, probably hips or shoulders first, probably in about 6 months or so. And we just haven't hit that 6 month mark yet.
Yeah.
It's coming up, and so far things are going well. So it's something we are keeping an eye on. And you know, we work with those blood vessels all the time.
Yeah.
But our group is going to end up doing an internal review of the literature to make sure that it's something that has a strong enough base behind it of evidence before we start offering it.
Okay.
And obviously, you know, we're comfortable in the blood vessels, but it's going to be a new vascular bed that we'll be embolizing. So we just want to make sure that we're doing it safely and that we're doing it right.
Okay. Now, are they doing other joints over in, you know, Asia and over in the other side of the world?
It sounds like they are. It sounds like they've tried it on kind of every joint we have.
Okay.
But that being said, you know, I have no plans currently I had a patient the other day ask me about doing it on like cervical spines. I was like, we are very far away from that.
Yeah.
That's, there are some vascular beds where I think there's just a lot of risk.
Yeah.
And there's a reason that those procedures aren't widely done.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that too. It's going to take a little bit of work, I'm assuming. So And probably more robotic technique too to assist, you know, down the road.
Absolutely.
You know, if there is there anything differently you would do as, you know, pursuing your career in medicine? Is there anything you'd do differently or any other way you would have gone other than vascular surgery?
I wanted to do something procedural. When I was in college, I grew up in California. I'd go home for breaks, and I did some shadowing with an interventional radiologist. And there's a lot of overlap between what IR docs do and some of the endo stuff that vascular does. And so IR interventional radiologists also provide this procedure, GAE. I'm not aware of anyone doing a ton of them around here. Which is one of the reasons why it's such a need and that we're offering it. But that was something else that I did consider. And then when I got into med school and we had a lecture on peripheral arterial disease and I realized, oh, I could do open surgery and do the minimally invasive stuff. That's what really sold me on vascular. So I wouldn't do anything too differently. I think it's medicine's a really rewarding and great field, in whatever aspect you happen to practice it. I think it's more of just being persistent and realizing that there's always something to learn, even if you think, you know, you want to do this, well, you might end up doing something else.
Yeah.
Or you might just be doing that and something else.
Now, I always try to, you know, ask the question about mentorship to other colleagues and how they perceive mentorship or even, for doctors, because I feel like there's always that person that you will go to if you have a hard question or a hard case, or even through, you know, education and through learning. Was there that person for you that kind of helped you along the way, or is there more than one person and do you still go to that person for advice and for help?
There were a lot of those people, and yes, mentors are something that I think you accumulate as time goes on. Or at least in my own personal experience, you tend to have a lot of different mentors who might specialize in different areas, even within vascular surgery or within, you know, the research realms or just with like the business of medicine, things like that. Everyone has their own interests and has their own expertise. And so these are people, you know, if I have a question about this really tough case that I'm doing and it's an aortic aneurysm and I need to know something about endovascular techniques for it or ask what they would do, you know, I've got people that I can call. If I'm doing it in an open fashion instead, it's big open surgery, I've got people I can call. If, you know, even my own partners that I work with, it's like, hey, how would you tackle this case? There's actually a lot of that even once you get out into practice of, okay, you know, here's this case, this is what I'm planning on doing. Does anyone have any other ideas? Is there a better way to do this? And that itself, that case review, I also think is a form of mentorship because you really get, you know, kind of the best minds in the room and the best ideas out there.
Yeah, I mean, we do that in therapy too. I still call on other clinicians and, you know, athletic trainers that I work with and, you know, physical therapists if we have a difficult case. Same thing. I think we're all trying to make each other better and try to provide the best for the people that we're working with, but also the people that we're caring for. So it's definitely, I think the education piece never changes, even if you're out of school. So I think we're always continuously educating ourselves. So I think it's important.
That's right. We always joke about being lifetime learners, but it really is true.
It is true. It is true. And I always say education is never wasted. So the more you can get, the better you're going to be at your craft. And it's always going to keep it interesting for you as the clinician. For that, you know, young, rising, you know, student that's looking to go into a career of medicine, do you have any advice, you know, given your journey and how you navigated that and where you're today, do you have any advice for them to maybe help them make it a little bit easier or, you know, a path they may want to kind of look at to kind of help them along?
Well, one of the things I always tell folks that are on their rotations when they're trying to like figure out what they want to do, and I this is maybe a little bit more specific because it's folks who have already kind of taken those first couple steps, but they're in school, whether it be PT or PA or medical residency or medical school, you know, say I tell them like, hey, listen, if you're on a rotation where you're getting exposure to something new, imagine you could be doing that for the rest of your life. How does that look? How does that make you feel? like treat every rotation like you could be doing this for the rest of your life. And if you find something where you're happy every day because you love going to your work, you love going to your job, like that's the one. And also keep an open mind because, again, like we've been talking about, there's always something to learn.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. I think the more you put into it, the more you get out of it. And it's going to make your, you know, what you do every day, it's going to be make it like you're not going to work, which is an important thing. You got to love what you do.
Right.
And if you're doing that, you're going to make some differences in the, you know, people you're working with in any career that you do, whether it's business or medicine or, you know, whatever, education. Well, again, I want to thank you for today. I know your time is precious. You're probably very busy on a nice long weekend.
Hopefully long call, so no worries.
Hopefully you're off on Monday.
I'm on call on Monday.
Well, hopefully you don't get many calls. Let's put it that way.
Appreciate it.
Well, everybody, Dr. Zachary Fang, the Vascular Group in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Their information will be in the show notes. If anybody has any questions, you can always directly email me at ajrsportscience.com. And Dr. Fang, again, thank you for taking the time out of your day. And I hope you enjoy the rest of the weekend.
I really appreciate you having me on the show.
Great. Thanks. I'll talk to you soon. Appreciate it.
See you soon.
Thank you for tuning in to the Behind the Sports Medicine podcast, proudly sponsored by AJR Sports Science and Healthcare Consulting. At AJR, we are committed to offering a comprehensive range of exceptional services, including applied sports science analytics, healthcare and sports medicine consulting, and leadership and coaching development. To learn more about AJR, visit their website at ajrsportscience.com. This is your host, Andrew Rizza. If you enjoyed today's episode, give us a like, comment, and share it on social media. Access all of our episodes on platforms such as Apple, Spotify, or your preferred podcast app. Stay updated by following us on Instagram at Behind Sports Med Podcast, on X at AJR Sports Sci, or visiting our website at ajrsportscience.podbean.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at AJR Sports Science for upcoming content. Thank you for tuning in and stay tuned for our next episode.